is the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the committee. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to come before the committee. I have very brief remarks, and I've been advised by staff to be very brief.
So yeah, that's fine.
As you all know, OAH is an executive branch agency that functions as a court. We provide trials to people either challenging government action or seeking workers' compensation benefits. There's about 12,000 matters filed with us every year. We do this work with 67 employees, all dedicated public servants, about half of which are judges. Well over half of our filings are handled by our workers' compensation judges. They work hard every day to ensure the rights of injured workers and employers are protected as required by the law. Because this is such a focus of our work, I am very proud to have with me here today two of the most respected leaders of the workers' compensation bar, Mr. Jay Hartman, who has spent decades representing the rights of employers, and Mr. Tom Motaz, who spent the same decades representing the rights of injured workers.
And do these individuals want to wave?
Please.
Oh, over here? Great. I didn't see you to the right. Thank you.
The fact that they're here together in support of my confirmation is my greatest honor, and I thank you for being here. On the other side of our business, we hear cases involving disputes with over 100 state government agencies and boards. It's our job to ensure that the public's rights to due process are protected and that agencies stay within the confines of the law. For example, if the Department of Commerce seeks to revoke a realtor's license, that realtor has a right to come to OAH to have a trial to determine whether or not that was actually done fairly. Or if a veteran who's seeking employment feels that their veterans' preference rights have been avoided unfairly, they have a right to come to OAH for a hearing. And our administrative law judges simply conduct fair and impartial hearings to resolve these disputes. We also provide due process hearings for school districts or parents in special education matters. We review every state agency's rulemaking procedures to make sure they're fair and they comply with the law. And we also review all of the utility work that the Public Utilities Commission does with regard to setting rates or routing transmission lines or other energy facilities. It is important work and work that I am proud to be tasked to do. And with my 30 years of experience as a lawyer and in leading other state agencies, I believe I'm uniquely qualified to do this work. And so with respect, I ask for your votes in support of my confirmation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for Judge Pust? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. According to this resume that we have here, it shows that Ms. Pust was a consultant for the Children's Defense Fund and that she coordinated campaigns to increase Head Start program funding. How do you feel about that today?
I think the Head Start program has evolved a lot in the 20 years since I did that work. I think the Head Start program still does important work in providing school readiness for children of families of low-income status. I know that on a federal level, Head Start has been reformatted and reworked in a lot of ways, and Minnesota has been a leader in providing service or state dollars in support of the Head Start work so that all of our kids enter school ready to learn.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I guess I would disagree with that because I received a report that came out of Washington, D.C., that says that the Head Start program has not, from statistics of over years past, have not shown it to be significantly successful. So I'm just interested to see what your perspective was on that.
I'd be interested in seeing that report, Senator Anderson, because I had actually heard that success is shown in the first couple years after Head Start, but then it does erode because the support in elementary school for those children that is not there. So the growth that they saw, Senator Hayden is kind of nodding.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, I think that Head Start gets a little bit of a bad rap on the longitudinal side. I think that not only the support in school, but also the socioeconomic conditions of the children that come from there have also played a part in it. But I do think that, not a big plug for Head Start, but I know that I have some in my district that are all rated very high on all the rating scales and does a very good job at providing school readiness for children. So I'd love to just kind of have that conversation so that we can walk through that. I think that that's a great conversation, but I most certainly wouldn't hold Ms. Pusa, I'd hold it against her for for her pursuit of helping.
20 years ago,
trying to help children become school ready.
Are there any other questions for Judge Pust? Senator Scalzi.
Not a question, but I would just, Ms. Chair and members, I've known Judge Pust for a number of years, and I know she's a great member of the community. She's helped the community grow and do well, and so I just would support her confirmation.
Would you like to move the
I would.
Confirmation motion?
I certainly would.
Okay, the motion is Senator Scalzi moves that the Committee on State and Local Government recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Ms. Tammy Pust as the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very
All right.
much.
Thank you very much. Next, we have the State Arts Board and the confirmees. Are David Glenn and Thomas Moss, and I believe Sue Gens is here as well, the executive director. Oh, and Wendy Dayton. So there are one is here and two are not able to be here.
Madam Chair,
Gens.
Members of the committee, my name is Sue Gens. I'm the executive
Gens.
Director of the Minnesota
Sorry,
State
Gens.
Arts Board. So I am the chief of the professional staff that supports the work of the board. I wanted to say just a couple of things about what we do and then have Mr. Glenn introduce himself and talk about his qualifications. And I'll close with a few comments about Mr. Moss and Ms. Dayton, who are unable to be with us today. The Arts Board is an executive branch agency. Our authorizing statute is Chapter 129D. We are, by statute, directed to stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state of Minnesota. We have 11 members of the board. Each congressional district is represented, and we have 3 members who serve at large. The principal role of the board is to be good stewards of state resources. We receive just under $35 million in funding from the general fund and from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we use those dollars to make grants. We review about 1,400 to 1,500 grant applications a year. We make 500 to 600 grants a year. So their fiscal oversight is terribly important. I understand that you have the information that was provided to the Secretary of State's office, so you have their background and your resumes, and we won't go through that. But Mr. Glenn is here to talk a little bit about his background and to respond to any questions.
Thank you. And thank you, Senators.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn.
My name is David Glenn. I live in St. Augusta, Minnesota, just outside of St. Cloud. I have been involved with the arts community in Minnesota since moving here 25 years ago, and have been involved in a lot of different aspects of the arts community. I am very honored to have been selected to serve on the State Arts Board because I think that the Minnesota State Arts Board is a model, and the regional arts council systems are a model for the nation as far as being able to ensure that the funds that are allotted to the State Arts Board and to the regional arts councils get distributed throughout every county of the state. And that's something that, as someone who's come from small communities and from rural communities, I find really important to have that access and that access to input as to how those funds are distributed to the artists and to the communities that they serve. So it's with great pride that I'm there, here. Also, I'm an avocational artist. I'm a potter. I don't try and make my living from my artwork. That's a challenge that I worked with over 700 professional artists through the Minnesota Crafts Council years ago. That is a big challenge for artists to do, and I have a lot of respect for those artists who make their living from their artwork. So I hope that I can bring to the board aspects from individual artists and working artists in the field.
Is this your first term, Mr. Glenn?
It is.
Okay. Is anyone here from Stearns County? No. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Glenn? Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Either to Ms. Jens or to Mr. Glenn. You know, last year there was an investigation on the use of money from the legacy, I guess it was from the legacy to the Arts Board. The Arts Board, there were members of the Arts Board that took trips outside of the state of Minnesota with money that was given to the Arts Board. How do you feel about that?
Just to clarify, I'm not sure if it was Arts Board members or artists who might have received individual grants for travel to do study outside the state of Minnesota. I personally think that it's important that individual artists have an opportunity to learn from other artists, and Minnesota is graced with the fact that we have artists who are recognized internationally as well as nationally, so many of the artists that we have that travel. I also understand budget restrictions and how the use of state dollars. So I guess that's really going to be – I'm going to leave that in the hands of the legislature, but I honestly think that those were probably good investments of dollars, but that's my individual opinion. So.
Any other questions? Then, Ms. Did I get it wrong? Is it Gens?
It's Jens.
It's Jens. You were right. Sarah Anderson was right. Jens. Ms. Jens, would you want to talk about the other two?
If I may, for just a moment.
I couldn't make it.
Thank you. With regrets, both Wendy Dayton and Tom Moss are not able to be here today. They are outside of the state, actually. A few things about Wendy Dayton. You have her resume. She is an arts advocate. She is a civic leader and a philanthropist. She and her now late husband created their own family foundation some numbers of years ago. She has been a lifelong supporter and a person who's been involved in the arts since she started as a volunteer at the just then built Guthrie Theater in the 1960s. She has studied in the arts. She has served on 10 or 12 different arts organizations' boards through the years. She's also served on boards at the University of Minnesota, the Tubman Center, the Children's Medical Foundation, the Trust for Public Lands. So her philanthropic and community interests are wide and are varied. She is very eager to help the Arts Board work with artists and organizations to enhance their service to the state, to identify institutions and projects that we can be partners with to advance the arts in the state. And she's especially interested in arts education for people of all ages. She is a resident of Wayzata. She represents the 3rd Congressional District. Mr. Moss, some of you may know from the years that he worked in state government. He was a staff member in the office of Governor Jesse Ventura. Before that, he was the deputy commissioner and was a director in the Department of Human Services for quite some number of years. So he brings a great deal of state government experience. He also has a very strong interest in the arts. He's had a long association with the McPhail Center for Music in Minneapolis. He was the chair of the campaign that built the new building that's in downtown Minneapolis, and he served as CEO of that organization for a period of time. He's now a consultant working on his own and also with Public Strategies Group. He's a consultant to nonprofit organizations and government agencies. And the thing that he brings to us that really is important and unique is that he's done a tremendous amount of work in performance measurement in governments and nonprofits. So as we do more and more to measure the impact of the dollars that we are investing, he will be a terrific resource to help us do that work. So that's a little bit about each of them. I'd be happy to answer questions that you might have. They each have been with us for about 8 months now. All of them have gotten active in committees and have been tremendously engaged in the short time they're with the board. So we hope that you will approve them to continue serving.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me on Ms. Dayton, is she related to the governor?
Madam Chair. Senator Hall, yes, she is. She is his aunt.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Hall?
I wonder if I could ask Mr. Glenn a question here, just to clarify.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Glenn, you made it sound like you were okay with taxpayer dollars, and I just want to make sure I'm correct. With taxpayer dollars going towards those that artists that would travel outside of the state, possibly around the world, to enhance their abilities. And I just wanted to make sure. I know we've put a restriction on that for the last, I think this year and next year, if I'm not mistaken, it's sunset. So you would be okay with lifting that restriction?
Mr. Glenn.
Yes, I would. I think that it's probably appropriate. I've been asked to jury a show in St. Louis. I'm leaving in next week to do that, and I know that Minnesota artists are going to be in that show and stuff, so I know that Minnesota artists benefit when they go outside the state, and I know that we benefit by bringing artists into the state. So artists tend to not see the boundaries, and actually in a lot of the cultural activities and stuff. So I would like to see that lifted, but I also am not going to fight that because it's not – in the bigger scheme of things, we can work without that. But
we're ready for a motion. Does anyone want to make the motion? We can do all three at once. Senator Hayden. Then Senator Hayden moves that the Committee on State and Local Government recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Mr. David Glenn, Mr. Thomas Moss, and Ms. Wendy Dayton as board members of the Minnesota Board of Arts.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I would like to remove David Glenn from that and do him separately.
All right. Then let's remove Mr. Glenn and just take Mr. Thomas Moss and Ms. Wendy Dayton as board members. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Now, Senator Hayden moves that the Committee on State and Local Government recommend that the Senate confirm the appointment of Mr. David Glenn as a board member of the Minnesota Board of Arts. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Then we're moving on to Gambling Control Board. Is anyone here from the Racing Commission? Is anyone here from the Racing Commission? You're not from the Racing Commission, either one of you. Okay, we're going to remove the Racing Commission confirmations from the agenda. We'll just schedule it another time when they can be here, at least one representative. Okay, so you're just doing, where's Crisco? You're just doing the Gambling Control Board, and I'll be right back.
All righty.
So
we have to go, right? We can stay? Okay. Who's starting? Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Barrett, I'm the Director of the Gambling Control Board. With me today is one of our board members that's up for confirmation, Mr. Ken Cook. Let him explain some of his background, but by way of information for the committee, the Gambling Control Board oversees charitable gaming, Minnesota, $1.2 billion industry. We have a seven-member board, five are appointed by the governor, one is appointed by the Attorney General, and one is appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Mr. Cook is appointed by the governor.
Okay. Mr. Cook?
Madam Chair, committee, thank you for allowing me to come today in front of you and answer any questions you may have about my background. And I want to say that I'm very proud to be associated with charitable organizations in the state of Minnesota. I've been a member of the Egan Lions Club International for the past 10 years, and this year serve as the club president, as well as assisting our organization with compliance with the Gambling Control Board, and now participating statewide within the Gambling Control Board. I'm a self-employed businessman, small business, have been doing that the majority of my life and career. So I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Mr. Cook. Seeing none, would someone like to make the motion? Senator Johnson moves that the Committee on State and Local Government recommend that the state confirm the appointment of Mr. Kenneth Cook as a board member of the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Congratulations. Okay, we're going to go to the presentation and discussion of the Office of the Legislative Auditor report.
Madam Chair, I'm Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor. With me at the table is Joe Voss, who was the manager of the evaluation we are here to discuss. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are here to discuss a report, an evaluation, a performance audit, if you will, that concluded that state government could and should do better. Now, I think for those of you who have been around the Capitol, that does not come as a shocking statement from the legislative auditor. In fact, we could say probably every report that we release finds some way in which we think state government could work better. We are in the business of trying to find ways for state government to work better, and often that requires that we recommend change. Change in structures, change in approach, change in the way we do things. And sometimes it requires us to come to the legislature and suggest that you clarify exactly what you want a particular program or organizations to accomplish. So, Madam Chair, the report we are here to discuss today, an evaluation of the Councils on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Black Minnesotans, Chicano Latino People, and the Indian Affairs Council, really is not unusual in any way. It is simply our attempt to provide you, the executive branch, the people of the state of Minnesota, with information that will point us in the direction of improvement and change. And we think this touches on an area of state government that is of vital importance, that you as policymakers and those in the executive branch as well obtain the input, counsel, and guidance from communities that have not historically had the level of representation that they should have. And having councils or having some other kind of structure is a way that we can do that. So, Madam Chair, I would now like to turn the mic over to Joe Voss, again, who is the manager of this evaluation. She'll make a brief presentation of our findings and recommendations. And, Madam Chair, thank you for inviting us to be here today.
Thank you, and welcome, Ms. Voss.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'm here to summarize our evaluation on the state's four councils. I'm going to keep my presentation short, and I'm going to sort of focus on the big picture. I'm not going to get into any detail on the individual councils. We have a chapter in our report, each of the councils. We've devoted a chapter to each of the councils in our report if you want additional information. Before I begin, though, I would like to introduce Laura Schwartz, another member of our research team, and Jody Rodriguez from our staff also worked on the project. So with that, I think I'll begin by briefly describing what it is that the councils are supposed to do. State law spells out a wide variety of duties for the councils, and we've listed those duties on page 8 of our full report. Overall, their statutory duties fall into two general categories. First of all, the councils must act as advisors to state policymakers. And second, they must act as liaisons to state government for constituent organizations or, in the case of the Indian Affairs Council, tribal nations. The bottom line is that overall we found very little evidence that the state's four councils have been effective advisors to state policymakers or effective advisors or effective liaisons to state government. We think changes are needed to provide Minnesota's minority communities with more effective representation, and we present four options for the legislature to consider. These options range from implementing some fairly simple operational changes to more significant structural changes. So let me backtrack just a bit now and provide just a little bit of background information on the four councils. First, they've been around a long time, somewhere between 30 and 50 years. Each council is overseen by a board of directors appointed by the governor or, in the case of the Indian Affairs Council, tribal nations. The councils vary in terms of their size and the qualifications that the board members must have. We show all of the different differences between the councils in a chart on page 5 of our full report. Each council, or board as they're sometimes referred to, hires its own executive director. And the councils are generally pretty small. They have relatively small budgets and few staff. We identified six overarching problems that affect each of the councils in varying degrees, and I'll run through each of these problems one by one. The first problem that we identified is that the councils are not well integrated into state policymaking. We refer to this a lot of times in our report as being structurally isolated. The councils were created as freestanding state agencies in the executive branch. They are not, however, directly accountable to the governor. The governor appoints council members, and councils in turn hire their executive directors. There are no direct oversight links between the executive directors and the governor. Likewise, the councils are only partially accountable to the legislature. They do not routinely report to any of the legislature's policy committees, and while they appear before the Finance and the Appropriations Committees for their budgets are small. Overall, the legislature does not spend a great deal of time looking at the council's statutory responsibilities and the activities that they do. In addition, most of the councils can only operate programs if they're directed to do so specifically by the legislature or the governor. In addition, the councils don't have any authority to change programs operated by other state agencies. We talked with quite a few council members and council staff, and many of them told us that they do not feel that they always have adequate access to state policymakers. They also said that at times when they do have access, they don't always feel that they're taken seriously. The second problem that we identified is that the councils have no clear statutory purposes. As I noted before, statutes set forth a wide variety of duties for the councils. But without some overall purpose in law, the councils have no legislative guidance as to how they should prioritize their activities or what the legislature really expects of them. Third, we found that the councils have done little to fill this statutory void themselves by clarifying expectations or by measuring the results of their work. Now, the councils are required to submit annual reports to the governor and the legislature, and these annual reports are supposed to contain specific objectives the councils hope to achieve, and at least for the last 2 years, the reports are supposed to contain outcome measures. Well, we looked at what the councils have produced in these two respects, and we found that the councils are generally focused on simply cataloging or listing their activities, instead of trying to measure the impact of those activities. We found that the councils have, to varying degrees, been engaged in strategic planning, but again, these plans have generally not contained any outcome measures that would help the legislature or the councils themselves examine their own effectiveness. The fourth issue we found is that there's been little substantive collaboration among the four councils. And I find this somewhat baffling because the statutes give the councils very similar duties. In addition, when the councils have talked with their own constituents, the constituents often have similar concerns and problems. For example, they're concerned about education, concerned about economic development, about health issues. Yet the councils have seldom, if ever, initiated any joint projects or activities. Now, in the last 2 years, the councils have begun to meet as a group, but this has come at the initiative of the Commissioner of Human Rights and not the councils themselves. Our fifth overarching issue has to do with council appointments and meeting attendance. We looked at the appointments process over an 11-year period and found lengthy delays in the time required for the governor to appoint voting members to some of the councils. For example, the time elapsing between the expiration of a member's term and the appointment of a new member to the Asian Pacific Council has averaged a little over 2 years. And although state law for the Asian Pacific Council says that no ethnic community can have more than one representative on the council, there are currently four Asian Indians on the Asian Pacific Council. We also noted attendance problems. For example, the Council on Black Minnesota meets monthly, and it had a quorum at only 58% of the meetings it held in 2013. The Indian Affairs Council meets quarterly, and it had quorums at only 2 of the 9 meetings it held between January 2012 and December 2013. And I hesitate to put this little line up, but we found attendance is even worse when it comes to legislative members of the of these councils. On average, legislative members attended less than 30% of council meetings over the last 6 years. Finally, we found some significant communication problems. As part of our evaluation, we surveyed as many constituent organizations as we could find that work primarily with Asian Pacific populations, Black populations, and Latinos. We also conducted in-depth interviews with a small sample of these organizations, as well as a small sample of organizations representing American Indians. The organizations responding to our survey expressed relatively low levels of satisfaction with their respective councils. We found little support for or knowledge of council activities, and many of the organizations reported having little contact with their respective councils. Now, we thought, well, council websites are a good way to sort of keep your constituents informed about what you're doing. And so we looked at council websites, and we found that with the exception of the Chicano Latino Council's website, most of the websites are pretty bad. The Council on Black Minnesotans did not have a working website for several months this summer, and the Asian Pacific website hasn't really been updated for the last 2 years. So we think there's a lot of room for improvement there. So what to do? We present 4 options for the legislature to consider, and we don't have a recommendation or endorse one option over another, but we do think that more change rather than less change is needed. And so I will run through each of these options very briefly. First, the legislature could maintain the 4 councils as currently structured, but require certain operational changes. Under this option, the legislature would clarify the council's primary purposes in statute. The legislature would also require the councils to adopt strategic plans that contain specific objectives the councils hope to achieve, as well as outcome measures that would measure the effect or the effectiveness of the council's activities. Furthermore, the councils would be required to report back to one of the legislature's policy committees on a yearly basis, sort of to provide an update on progress on their plan. The legislature would also require the councils to develop policies and procedures and to work more substantively with other state agencies, including other councils. We think this option would improve legislative oversight, but it would not address some of our other concerns, including lack of integration into state policymaking, attendance problems, or the timeliness of appointments. Our second option goes a little bit further and introduces some structural change. Under this option, the legislature would maintain the 4 councils but move them under the Department of Human Rights. It would also require the legislature and the councils to adopt the operational improvements that I just outlined in Chapter 1, having a strategic plan, reporting back to a policy committee. This option would make the Commissioner of Human Rights, instead of the governor, the appointing authority for council members. We think that there are several advantages to moving the councils under the Department of Human Rights. First of all, it would decrease the structural isolation of the councils and provide a closer link to the governor's office, since the Department of Human Rights is part of the governor's executive cabinet. It would also allow for greater oversight, increase the timeliness of appointments, and make for a quicker response to attendance problems. This option would also provide the councils with much-needed support in areas such as website maintenance. There are disadvantages, though. This option would decrease the council's independence and make them perhaps more partisan. This option might also increase costs to the Department of Human Rights beyond the budgets the councils would bring with them when they were transferred. Under option three, the legislature would eliminate the councils altogether and create a new state agency in the executive branch. The governor would appoint an executive director for the new office who would organize it as he or she found most appropriate. The new agency would have the authority to bring together policymakers from several state agencies and community organizations, bring them together in advisory groups to address the top concerns of minority communities in a single strategic plan. There are some advantages to doing this. Most importantly, it would perhaps be a more cohesive approach than having four separate councils, and it may lead to more cooperation among the different minority communities and among different state agencies. The downsides is that the new agency would likely be small in terms of budget and staffing, and it would have many of the same problems that small agencies have in trying to get support functions. Also, in our interviews with constituent organizations, we found that they were largely opposed to having the councils merged together into one. Finally, our fourth option, the legislature would simply eliminate the councils altogether, and in their place, the legislature would require selected state agencies to pull together advisory groups to address disparities in their programs. And there's some precedence for this approach. Last year, the legislature required the Department of Human Services to establish a cultural and ethnic communities leadership council to address disparities in human services programs. And during this session in the House, they've heard a couple of bills that would do something similar in the departments of education and health. This option has several advantages. Most important, it places the responsibility for reducing disparities in the hands of agencies that operate related programs. Also, large state agencies are better integrated into state policymaking than the councils are, and they have more staff and resources. On the other hand, this option represents a much more narrow and focused approach than the councils currently have. Also, having multiple state agencies convene advisory groups may be duplicative for both agency staff and some of the key community organizations that would be expected to serve on these advisory groups. And again, we found considerable opposition among the constituent organizations that we talked with to eliminating the four councils. And that is our study in a nutshell. Depending on the option endorsed, we also have some specific recommendations related to the Indian Affairs Council that you can find on page 79 of our report. With that, I'm happy to take questions. I know the councils are here, too, to respond.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Voss or Mr. Nobles, on page 19, it talks about you making a recommendation, and then you're patterning it after either Maryland or New Jersey or Iowa, and I'm just wondering if you have some examples or some positives or negatives from those states in the way they dealt with realigning or helping these different groups be better, more efficient, more effective, and just wondering what maybe you don't have anything on those states.
Madam Chair, Senator, we did not look beyond how effective the councils were in those states. We did look just to see, in general, what kinds of structures other states may use that we might pattern ourselves after, and that's about the extent of it. We did not look to see how effective or if those councils did more than our councils did.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Voss, do you know how many other than the ones you've mentioned here, how many other states also have kind of taken your recommendations or are gone along with a different way of handling these different groups that were
mentioning?
Ms. Voss.
Madam Chair, Senator, we looked to find, we found about 8 states that have 4 councils like we do. We looked, first of all, we tried to find information on all of the states and what kinds of councils they have, and we found 8 states that have other councils. And Laura, do you want to add your 2 cents? This is Laura Schwartz from our office, who did most of our work with the other states.
Madam Chair,
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Laura Schwartz with the Legislative Auditor's Office. As I recall, there were 8 states that had 4 or more councils, and then I believe 5 of them had some sort of overarching structure. But there were many other states that also had some sort of minority council.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Schultz, do you know how they are arranged as far as reporting to the governor or to the legislature, or did you have any kind of feedback on that?
Madam Chair, I can't tell you the number off the top of my head, but many of the councils had fairly similar structures in that they were created by the legislature and they reported back to the legislature, or they were created by the governor and reported to the governor.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it's safe to say that there is a variety of arrangements out there, and all the states seem to handle it a little differently.
Senator Horsray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this report. We very much appreciate it. Before I ask a few questions, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure I understand who is present in the audience representing this council. So I would like to know, I'm going to call because it's the only way I can get a sense. I do recognize the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Council is here and some members of our board. How many members of the Asian Pacific Council board are here?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's our vice chair.
Okay, thank you. So I also recognize the Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, and I don't know if there are any members of the board of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council present. Senator Nelson and I are serving in the board as well. I recognize the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans is here as well.
Mr. McDonald.
Mr. McDonald, and do you have any members of your board here?
Madam Chair, Senator, they could not make this time. It was inconvenient.
Thank you. And I do not see the Executive Director of the Indian Affairs. Okay, yes, I see you in the back. Thank you. So I recognize the Indian Affairs Executive Director. I don't know if you have any board members here. And I know they will be coming back. And I just wanted to ask a few questions and wanted to make sure that the board members, have this information. So I do, obviously, I do recognize the executive directors, but the boards have a tremendous responsibility.
And Senator Torres Ray, on the back of your agenda, some of them have asked to address the committee.
Wonderful. Thank you. So I wanted a clarification with respect to the appropriation. Report, you stated that they receive an appropriation of $3 million a year, or is that a biennium?
Ms. Voss.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, $3 million is their, all 4 councils spent about $3 million in total during fiscal 2013.
Okay. A year.
So that's a year.
So it's a year.
It's
yes.
A year.
Yes.
And approximately how many staff work for the entire group, all the councils together? How many people are working for
Chair,
the councils?
Senator Ray, I think there was about 15 or 16 staff.
15 to 16 people. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to kind of put some context to, I am very familiar with the work that the councils do, partnered with them in many, many ways, and I was asked by the majority leader to serve in the Chicano Latino Affairs Board this particular term. And I am I'm very sad and very disappointed to review this report. And I am thankful for the time that you put into this, because I think, I know that you interviewed a number of people throughout the state, and I know that you put a lot of time into that. But really don't know how to approach the recommendations. I believe that you explained very clearly the limitations that we have with each and every single one of them. I have to share with the members that these, unfortunately, these outcomes reflect some of the frustrations that I anecdotally have heard in the community. And so this report is a welcome is something that I welcome, because I didn't know, you know, to what extent those frustrations that are brought to my attention in the office reflect the overall, you know, sentiment in the community. I know that Senator Champion and Senator Hayden have had a lot of conversations, and I'm not going to speak for you, Senator Hayden, but I know that Senator Hayden and Senator Champion share perhaps some of my sentiments in terms of what we feel is important that we do with communities of color, and how important it is that we as people of color assume some leadership and some responsibility to kind of review these carefully, these recommendations and this presentation very carefully, and figure out a solution. I would like to ask members to help us really pay attention to what is being presented today. I think this is not a new issue, Madam Chair and members. We do need your support. The disparities that affect communities of color are very significant, and you know those very well. And we have an opportunity to spend significant resources. For me, $6 million in a biennium are significant resources to bring the voices of those communities both to the legislature and the executive. And I would like to find a better solution. But I very much hope that we look for a constructive solution, because we do need these voices at the legislature. And I just wanted to put that statement in front of you, because this is not an easy task. And I also want to make sure that we do this collectively, because although I appreciate the energy and the attention that Senator Champion and Senator Hayden have put into this, and some members of the House, I do not believe that this is the responsibility of the legislators of color. This is the responsibility of the legislature. All of us need to do this collectively. So I hope that we can find a way to work together to find some solutions.
Is there anyone else who has questions for the auditor? Oh, I think Senator Hossett did.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, Ms. Voss, if there could be an option 5 to maybe sunset the council until we get maybe more answers or some a different outlook.
Madam Chair, Senator Housley, actually these councils were up before the Sunset Commission last year, and it was the judgment of the legislature at that time to continue them. It is always the option of the legislature during this legislative session or any legislative session to abolish or put a sunset at some future date on these councils or any other organization in state government. So that is always an option. And I guess you could say that one of our options, or possibly two of them, suggested to you removing the councils and moving to a different structure. But we didn't make that recommendation because we didn't find that we could, among ourselves, come up with just one recommendation for how to make this work better. Madam Chair, if I could just extend my remarks on that for just a minute, because I really appreciate the comments of Senator Torres Ray, because over the years, I too have had many people from these various communities and these councils, board members and executive directors, come to me and ask us to do the evaluation that, frankly, we finally did. It's been on our list for many years, and it's been on our list not just because legislators wanted it on there, but these communities wanted it on there, and even many board members wanted it on there. And it's been a very sad experience for me, too, to often be in my office with people who have volunteered their time to work on these councils and end up feeling very frustrated that they aren't able to be more effective, or even speaking to executive directors who have felt that same frustration. So it's also, I think, sad, and I have to say this, that it's hard for the people that you just recognized, Senator Torres Ray, who are in this room, to be those people who have worked hard and tried to make this be an effective instrument in state government. But it is the structure, we think. It is all of the things that Ms. Voss went through that are the things that need to be addressed. There are individuals who are trying to make this work, but what we are saying is I think the legislature really needs to take a hard look at the structure, at the definition of purpose, at the place of these organizations in state government, and see if we can construct something that will make all of that work more effective.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was more about the legislative members. Until this moment, I didn't know who any of them were. I mean, I now know that Patricia is on the, and Senator Nelson's on one.
Senator Johnson and Senator Hayden, are you too?
Asian.
Okay. So I guess to me that strikes me as another issue is that I have no idea who's participating in these councils and what information they have. Patricia speaks very well for the Latino community, and but I didn't know for sure she was on the council, you know. So that just strikes me as an issue also.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles, and I've lost your name right before I said it. For Ms. Voss, for the report, we've had extensive conversations about the effectiveness of the councils of color. And in the 6 years that I've been here, I think your report highlighted, I think, what many of us have felt. And I think that the first thing we should do is to start with the legislature and the executive branch for probably not giving, and I think you've outlined that, the structure and the purpose and reviewing that. Some of these councils have been around and have gotten started for different reasons over time. And some of the issues are the same, but some of them evolve. Some go away. Some get exacerbated. So I think that we have not, kind of to go on to Senator Eaton's remarks, have probably not done a good job in providing them the necessary support in order for them to move forward. But with that being said, I also think that the councils clearly have had a tough time in trying to figure out what that is and what they should do. Some of that, though, we have to say that because we have so many disparities and are at the top of the list and so many of them, you know, I noted in the report that some of it is, and people have said it, that there's so many that which one do they address and how do they address it? And I think that often is a problem as we start to figure out the resources that we're putting to the folks that were asked to do the work. I've also had some conversations about this idea of, do the councils of color go out to the community, bring that information back, and then kind of develop a legislative agenda or something that is reflective of what they've been able to do in the limited capacity, I think, or do the councils of color work directly with the legislature, help to advise them, but set up a track in which they support what legislators are doing in that interplay? I also think that legislators on the committee are kind of ex officio, right? They're not voting members, and so they're there to help, but they really don't have a vote in the matters. So I just think, as we start to go, I just think we haven't done a very good job. One of the things that I also think is a problem is that we often get board members who are brought in because they're members of that particular community and they bring a voice to there, but they're not management. They don't always, some may, if they're professionals, may have supervisory experience, some may not, but we've left the administration of the group, the supervising of the staff to them, and that may or may not work depending on their skill level, their time commitment, or what they wanted to do. So then we have an accountability issue with that. And once again, we can take a lot of responsibility for it. So I think that as we start to think about what we need to do, it is clear that our demographics are growing, and so we need to have people who are going to help us and advise us and talk about all the great policies that we, or all the other policies, good or bad, depending on where you sit, and to get that through. We also know that we have significant issues in employment, healthcare access, the achievement gap, workforce development, et cetera, in this community. So there is an opportunity for us to help guide us through, and we have infinite amount of possibilities. So I think that, as Senator Torres Reyes said, that it is incumbent on all of us. I don't mind taking the lead as one of the, I mean, we have a disparity of people of color in the legislative body. And so we don't mind taking the lead on that, but it is incumbent of us to do it. And Senator Housley, I can see where this could be frustrating and that maybe we need to take a timeout or a break, but I think that what happens is that it's very hard to get going again, and then we're without this voice. And so I think that in this legislative body, we often look at things and we retool them, and we figure out how, if it's a necessary function. We typically don't throw the Department of Human Service out if they make a mistake, or the Department of Transportation if they're not doing what we want. We usually go back and figure out how they can do it better. And that's what I'm very interested in. You may have noticed that Senator Champion and I authored a bill, 2903, which we really thought would be a placeholder, which was aligned with one of your recommendations to put these councils under the Department of Human Rights, and I acknowledge that Commissioner Lindsay has joined us today, and we've tried to carve out a little bit of the Indian Affairs because of their nation-to-nation status. We're not sure that that's the right mix, but I think what it sent was a really clear message and brought people together to start to have these conversations that we need to have to move forward. So what I would hope is that as we move forward, that we take a good look at this and we work throughout the interim with legislative members, executive branch, the councils and their boards, as well as the communities in which they serve, and to see if we can start a pathway that actually allows us to define the structure, the mission, the purpose of these councils. I have a personal view. I would want to see these councils in these committee rooms a lot more than I do, but I can't 100% blame that for, because I don't know if they understand if the mission was to go out and bring things in or to follow things as they go along and comment on them. I think we need to define that purpose. I think there are a lot of issues that disproportionately affect people of color that we don't get enough information from that is non-biased and nonpartisan. And I think that that is the help. We get a lot of bias and partisan information that comes through, and that's helpful at some point. But to get it in a non-biased, nonpartisan way, I think really helps all members of the legislature. So, you know, once again, I know that there are some sad faces around and there are community members that are trying to figure it out, but I really commend your work that you've done, and I really would hope that as the parties that are involved, including the legislators, members of the executive body, and members of those councils, either board members or staff members, will really take this seriously, and we can start to work and move forward to try to develop a system that will really help these. Otherwise, I do think that, and these councils were in front of the Sunset Commission, and I do think that there will be a rallying cry, Senator Housley, that if we don't get this right, that there'll be a rallying call for them to go away, and I think that that would be a shame.
Senator Johnson, and then we do have a couple of the executive directors who wanted to address the report. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, I was appointed to the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans after in the beginning of last year's session. And for me, it was a real learning experience. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Didn't know whether I should speak up at the council. I didn't know if I could propose some even conversation without having the president of the board or chair of the board acknowledge me or ask me for my opinion. So I think there is something really missing, that legislators who are appointed get some training or some understanding of what their responsibilities are, and that the board also be informed about what is expected from the legislature. it's been a great experience for me. I would be very, very disappointed and sad if something happened to the CAPM. We are working very hard to try to study the purpose and the goals of the council and how to make them more visible with here in the legislature, especially during the session, especially. Our board and staff had Commissioner Lindsay come in twice, I believe, to help to educate all of us, legislators and board members, about what he would say our duties should be. And that was, I believe, very helpful for many people. We have begun working very hard at trying to have some impact. The Asian Pacific community is one that, I don't know if it's different from the others, but, you know, there are about 40 ethnic groups within that community. And many times when people think of the Asian Pacific community, what do you think about? I know what I thought about, China and Japan, you know. But and there, of course, those people are very much integrated into our society generally. But there are so many of the new groups of people that are coming in, the newest being from Burmese, right? Burma?
Karen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And these people are in such need, but they're not a very big component numbers-wise. But they're very important. And those are the people that we need to reach out to and bring forward to have their needs known, and having the agency people be more aware of the needs of the community. You look at the numbers for the Asian Pacific population, and you see that they're very high up when compared to the white people. And why is that? Because the majority, as I said, are probably from Japan and China and have been here a long time. But it's those smaller groups that need the attention and the help and the recognition of their needs. I'm very proud to say that our council has just appointed a new member to the board from the Karen group, and George, I don't remember his last name, but George, I think, will be a very valuable board member for us. So I would really encourage this group and us to not recommend that this council be sunsetted. And I don't think any of them should be right now. I think we're just getting an idea of how strong we can become if we work at it a little harder, legislators as well as board members.
Are there any other questions for the auditors, the legislative auditors?
If none, I did have another
Senator Johnson,
question.
Yeah.
You talked about the appointment process of the governor, and particularly kind of at the Council on Asian Pacific. And I think if I remember right, reading in here that you said something like there are such limitations on who can be appointed that sometimes even those people who would be very good for the board or the council are not able to be appointed because of restrictions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Madam
Foss.
Chair, Senator Johnson, for the Asian Pacific Council, there are 19 members. But as you indicated, there are probably 40 different countries represented on the council. And statutes have no ethnic community have more than one representative on the council. Statutes also have asked the Asian Pacific Council to define what is an ethnic community. Well, the council has never really done that in statute. Instead, they pretty much say, well, ethnic communities are countries except for the Hmong, which don't really have cut across country lines. So there are probably, you know, 40 different groups that could be represented on the council. But when a seat comes open, if you already have an Asian Indian on the council, then all the other Asian Indians who apply really shouldn't be considered. So that you've got to know what communities are not on the council in order to appoint somebody to the council. And if you have a new group coming over like the Karen, you may not have a lot of community members yet who are integrated enough into the society to apply for membership. So sometimes the governor's office gets 10 applications, but six of those might be from the same Asian, from the same ethnic community that's already on the council. So it's not always easy to find people who can qualify.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure. I think I saw that you have a copy of the governor's response.
Yeah, I was actually just...
It came in later, yeah. And we were not able to include it as we normally would have with the report. But I hope you all have a copy of that, because we did work closely with the governor's office, mm-hmm. and they wanted an opportunity to explain from their perspective some of the difficulties.
Excessive statutory restrictions, withdrawals of qualified candidates. They're talking about that they're trying to make them in a timely manner. Yeah.
And then I might add that the governor has, you know, a pretty stringent process whereby they screen candidates and check backgrounds and things. And so some candidates, you know, drop out along the way, or they find that they're not really interested or may not qualify once they've applied. So the candidate pool, you know, drops as time goes on.
Okay, thank you very much. Then I'd like to invite Mr. Garcia, the Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, does you need any help with the PowerPoint? All right, there we go.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Hector Garcia. I am the Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. I know that's a tongue twister, and I oftentimes just say the Latino First Council. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to respond to the OLA report, and I welcome the dialogue that might ensue from this series of presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was one of the persons who talked with Jim Nobles, the auditor, in 2010 about the need to do something about the disconnectedness of our council, the very limited resources to try to address the disparities of 300,000 Latinos, give or take a few. In the state of Minnesota, which are dispersed throughout the state, and the lack of specificity in the goal in the statute, which makes it very complicated to establish milestones and measurable outcomes. And I think you will see in the report that the Office of the Legislative Auditor acknowledges those very significant limitations. What I would like to do is to provide a larger context to what has been said so far. The world has changed with globalization, and the rules of the game have changed, the rules of the game that we must now play. And I believe this is highly significant for the subject that we're discussing here. Why? Because the United States used to be number one in education, in mobility and opportunity for economic improvement. It is now around 30th in some of those areas. It used to be the case that speaking foreign language was unnecessary. Why? Because English was the lingua franca throughout the world. It used to be unimportant for Americans to understand or be able to handle the cultures of other nations because everybody was trying to emulate American culture. I am sure we can all agree that that is quickly changing. Now, what does that mean in terms of the Latino community and other minority immigrant communities? 40% of our people are new immigrants. What it means is that all of a sudden, our community brings added value to the table. We bring bilingual capacity. We bring the understanding of other cultures and the ability to bridge communication and collaboration between those cultures. This paradigm shift is one that has already been enacted by international companies in Minnesota. 25 years ago, when I was a consultant, I would talk with CEOs sometimes, and they would say, Hector, we know what you have in mind. We have annual celebrations of diversity, and we fulfill our quotas. And I would say, I'm afraid that's not what I mean when I talk about the complementarity of cultures and the synergies that can arise from that complementarity. But today, if you go to 3M, or if you go to Cargill or Ecolab, you will find people like Mike Fernandez, Corporate Vice President of Cuban origin. You will find Ricardo Marchiani, a Venezuelan who speaks fairly broken English, who has nearly 6,000 people working under him throughout the world. Perhaps these individuals 20 years ago were selling 3M products or Cargill products in North Dakota. And all of a sudden, these corporations realized the enormous value of the individuals that were working with him. I believe that is the ultimate task of our council, to be able to convey this possibility of alchemy from the perception of minorities, in particular the Latino minority, from being a deficit to being an asset of great value to the state and to the nation. Demographic growth of Latino is enormous. Between 2000 and 2010, we went from up to 50 million persons in the nation, which was a 43% increase. In the state of Minnesota, our growth was even greater than that, although the numbers were smaller. 75% growth, while the European American community grew by 1.6%. Our median age was 24 years old compared to the overall median age of 40 years old. Latinos born in Minnesota, 14 years old. I'm sure you can quickly see what that forecast for the future. There's a great deal of concern with the retirement of the workforce, that those of us, those of our communities who will be filling those positions have the worst graduation rates and the worst achievement gaps in the nation. And it is not only in the area of education that Minnesota has the worst disparities. We do also in housing. We do also in health and in other areas, all of the areas of interest of the Latino Affairs Council. Our council was started in 1978. Perhaps at that time, our numbers and our impact on the state of Minnesota was inconsequential. Today, if you look at what the graduation rate of Minnesotans is at compared to the national graduation rate, you will see that it has fallen below the national graduation rates. When a minority is affected by disparities of income and social status, it is not only the minorities that suffer, but the whole population in that particular state or in that particular nation. If you take a look at the massive data that is presented by The Spirit Level, a book written by two British individuals, scholars in health, it becomes evident that disparities in income and social status dramatically affect the whole population.
Mr. Garcia, I apologize for interrupting you. I mean, clearly this is why the council was created, because there's an understanding of disparities. But that's a much longer conversation to give us an update on that, and we only really have time today for you to really comment on the auditor's report and maybe give us some advice as where you think we should go from here.
I only wanted to present the context, Madam Chair, but I will be more succinct.
We want you to wrap up in about 10 minutes.
I wanted to convey the importance of the subject that we're discussing.
We acknowledge that and understand that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Latino purchasing power nationally.
So, Mr. Garcia, I'm going to stop you short again, because it sounds to me like you're bringing in a extensive PowerPoint that's a broader subject than we have time to deal with today. So if you could kind of just limit your comments to, obviously we value the council, and nobody is proposing to sunset the council at this point, but we recognize there's some structural issues, some appointment issues that need to be resolved. And if you could just address those, if you have comments prepared for that. Otherwise, we can talk about it at a later date.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will move on to, you have copies of this document, so
okay.
I will not need to cover everything. But I do want to mention what the council has done recently, because this was questioned by the OLA report. I congratulate the OLA for the great work that they have done and pointing out some significant needs, especially in our being disconnected, our limited resources, and the lack of specificity in our statute. Nevertheless, I think there were pieces that they might have missed, mostly because this is new, and that was the main point that I was trying to make, that we are entering into a new situation and a new game of which the OLA team might not be aware.
And remember, Mr. Garcia, they did say that they recognized that the councils did have a lot of activities that they were involved in, mm-hmm. but have not identified specific objectives and outcome measures. And so, there is no criticism of how active you've been, or from the auditor's perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree. I think the terminology and the framing might be different, and perhaps that's where the misunderstanding lies. I think, for example, the cultural corridors that now everybody, including the Met Council, LISC, the Funders Collaborative, Alliance for Metro Stability, and other organizations are talking about constantly was something that CLAC initiated, partially thanks to the help of Senator Torres Rey. We have emphasized the contributions and potential, which is now being acknowledged also by Greater MSP, by DEED, and other entities and communication. That was also initiated by CLAC when there was no talk about those matters. Promoting the regular meetings was not only thanks to Commissioner Lindsay, who was mentioned earlier, but also thanks to the effort of CLAC, who initiated quarterly meetings with DEED, with the Department of Health. We recommended to the legislature that a bill be introduced to create a diversity council such as the one that exists for the Department of Human Services, And we have also supported that particular council for at least 2 or 3 years. Participating for 2 years in the Metropolitan Business Plan, one of the most important organizations in the metro area, for 2 years in the Regional Allies module and in the Entrepreneurship Accelerator, provided a presence. I was the only minority participating in those meetings, which is one of the problems and one of the reasons for the disparities themselves is that we are not at the decision-making tables. CLAC made that happen. We have fostered a fuller understanding of the Latino community by the majority community through several videos and documentaries that we have co-produced with Humanity Center, with SPNN, with TPT, with Minnesota Historical Society, for which we did not get an acknowledgement, I believe. We proposed to the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, of which I have been a member for a couple of years, and I'm a part of their executive committee. Recently, we initiated two pilot projects on crime and drugs in East St. Paul and Rochester that will be taking place this month. And finally, this Rochester project, which I think is a gem of vision, was thanks to CLAC, for which we also did not get much recognition. Why do I say that? Because DMC, as we now know, will now generate an investment of $6.5 billion. We started investing in Rochester 3 years ago, long before DMC was even talked about. Why did we choose Rochester? Because there were individuals such as Senator Nelson who saw the potential in our community, very different to what was seen in the Twin Cities and in other cities. They were able to acknowledge the value, the added value that we were bringing to the table, and that made all the difference. We started building on the foundations established already in Rochester, which is a fantastic city, by initiating with Art Rolnick, formerly with the Federal Reserve Board of Minneapolis and now with the Humphrey Institute, a guru in early education. We are exploring the possibility of creating an early education preschool center similar to the one in North Minneapolis, and we're copying that model with the knighted Norwegian economist Tordal, who made great contributions to Minnesota through the Minnesota Miracle, to the Chinese economy, and to his own nation's economy, as well as to health in Minnesota. We are exploring what the log jams might be in K through 12, and the superintendent of K through 12, of the school district, has now become a part of our board, Mike Munoz. We already have the support of Chancellor Rosenstone, Commissioner Casilius, Commissioner Pogemiller, for our work in higher education in Rochester. And we are establishing strategic alliances, which, to my mind, are highly measurable accomplishments. We are doing so with Mayo Clinic, with Art Rolnick and the Humphrey Institute. I just met with the dean of the Humphrey Institute last week, with United Way in Rochester, with ACLA, a Latino organization, and building on the programs that they're setting up. Art Rolnick has requested $1 million from the Mayo Clinic to build that early education center. We are trying to develop the type of collaborative that is the only way, in my opinion, to address the disparities. There are no silver bullets. There are no organizations or individuals who have an answer. Only collaboration can make that work.
So, Mr. Garcia, are you recommending then no change to the current structures of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council?
Thank you.
I'm trying to get you to focus here for a minute.
What I recommended in my written reply to the OLA, actually I sent them three different replies, was a combination of elements within their four options. And I still believe that there are elements in each one of those options that might bring about the type of collaboration that can be the only solution to the education and to the other disparities. This is a time, I believe, for the councils to be heard as they've never been heard before. I think this is the first time for the councils to contribute a great deal of added value to the state's economy in resolving what is an urgent need. Steve Young, former head of the Hamline School of Law, convened a group at the University Club, of which I was part, and he said, "This education achievement gap is the greatest threat to the future of the nation." And I believe it's an even greater threat to the future of Minnesota, but I also think it's a great opportunity for us to have hit rock bottom and start looking up towards collaboration and improvement of these conditions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Garcia? Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, I don't really have a question, and Mr. Garcia, thank you so much for coming over and your words, your preamble, as well as your presentation. And I would submit to the members of this committee that you have demonstrated some of the problems that I think we're having. It is not your approach to wanting to get things done. It isn't even your competency in terms of trying to figure out what's going on. It is the sheer magnitude of things in which you're trying to accomplish with the limited staff that you have, without really clear direction. I was just thumbing through the proposal, and it doesn't have a page number, but it was about the constituents. It says someone said that the writers of it said they also told us the councils need to do a better job setting public expectation regarding their priorities and what they can and cannot realistically accomplish. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is important to understand that the stuff that you went over, there's no way in the world that you could do much more than just kind of attend those meetings and be present, as opposed to putting together something that actually moves the agenda. This is not a criticism of you, Mr. Garcia, so I don't want you to take it personally, but I think the members have to look at this is part of the issue that we have, that we need, that the legislature needs to be able to help with community and you to really kind of dial it in, figure out what is your job relative to how do you interact with the community, and then how do you give that advice to us on things that are moving forth, legislation, appropriations, and others. And so though I appreciate your presentation, I think it does highlight some of the significant challenges we have if we move forward and try to figure out what we should do.
Thank you,
Senator. And I think on page 56, just to follow up with that, the auditor says, over the last 3 years, CLAC has fulfilled most of its statutory duties, choosing to largely emphasize its advisory role, being an advisor within state government. And I think that is, I mean, doing that is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But I think that's how the councils were really envisioned. And many of them now do kind of elaborate outreach to the community, which is very time-consuming and takes a lot of work and take on a lot of issues. I know the Asian Council, under previous leadership, even used to have their day at the Asian Council had their day at the Capitol, and you know, just extremely active. I think what we're hearing, though, is that for such a small staff and a small budget, we need to kind of help the councils figure out how they could focus more on exactly what their statutory duties are and should be, and not have such high expectations, as you were saying, from the community to be all things to all people.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, I'd just like to point out that it is very important that the role of bridging in communication and collaboration that the councils carry out is particularly essential at this point. It is my opinion that we need to do some heavy construction in bridge building because we have members of our community who come from extremely poor backgrounds, second, third grade education to a highly sophisticated socioeconomic situation in a state that has over 90% high school graduates among the persons of that age. There needs to be somebody building a bridge of understanding between the two. Let me give you a very quick example. I spent 1 year looking for a Latino construction company that would qualify as a DBE in order to receive contracts from the state or the cities, and never found one. I worked with the Latino Economic Development Center, with the Hispanic Chamber, and several others, and could not find one that would qualify. I then approached Kraus Anderson, where you know Mark Phillips is now working, and I said, would you consider mentoring a Latino construction company? There are thousands of Latino workers in the state of Minnesota, very talented, very skilled. But if we were to bring your way a Latino construction company, would you mentor them? And they said, yes, we would, just like Tor Construction and Mortenson did. And now Tor Construction, an African-American company, has over $100 million in sales. So the formula works. Even then, we were unable to find a Latino construction company. So now we have invited the management and the capital from another state to come and train and hire Latino construction workers in Minnesota so that they can begin to rise to other levels of performance and get the right type of contracts. That kind of bridge, in my opinion, is what is needed in education and in other areas. And that's where we would appreciate your help in making this possible and enhancing the capacity of our council and the other councils.
Thank you very much, Mr. Garcia. I appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the...
I'd like to invite Mr. McDonald, the Executive Director of the Council of Black Minnesotans. And just... though it's clear that we need to spend more time with each of the councils in the committee, we do have limited time today. So welcome, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this esteemed committee. Thank you for having me here. My name is Edward McDonald, Executive Director, Council on Black Minnesotans. I also just like to thank all of you for the hard work you've done here this legislative session. And I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words. And I'm going to keep my comments brief, Madam Chair, but I also would like the committee to note that in the back of the report are the formal statement of our board of directors to the report. We also then provided supplemental comments to the committee for this meeting. And as you know, the legislature created the Council on Black Minnesotans to ensure that people of African heritage fully and effectively participate and equitably benefit from the public, social, and economic resources and policies and procedures of the state of Minnesota, thus our mission and purpose. Our goals are outlined in 3.9225. They are titled by those who negotiated the relationship as duties. Therefore, in strategic planning for an entity of this nature, it is not your traditional strategic planning approach that you can deploy. It has to be one that many theorists in that area would call strategic doing. So they are activity-driven in order to accomplish the duties that moves us towards the purpose that have been defined by state statute. This arrangement established between the African Heritage Community and the state of Minnesota is one that we take very serious. We believe, and the archives show, that Minnesota, in doing so, was demonstrating its continued commitment to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Civil Rights Act of 64, and all the other equal access and opportunity provisions that permeate the operations of our nation-state government. We believe that neither OLA or anyone else should be allowed to usurp the long-established relationship between African heritage people and the state of Minnesota unless it is done through what is granted us in the provisions of 3.9225 to advance enabling legislation that alter the operational approach that we have with our state government. Madam Chair, right now, the Council on Black Minnesotans' biggest disappointment is that 12 African heritage community-driven legislative proposals were authored in the House this session. Our community was only given the opportunity to participate in the social political deliberation here on five of those bills. The thoughtfulness and consideration and the hard work that our community engaged in over the course of 6 to 8 months to fashion public policy recommendations that we believe, if deployed, would take a big bite out, if not move us towards eradicating disparities. Unfortunately, we had five hearings in the House. None of those bills will pass this session. Only two of those bills were able to achieve authorship in the Senate, and none were here. This is the first time our council has been invited into the Senate chambers to have a discussion. And it's about a audit that you will see we totally disagree with. But when you drill down into the audit and focus not on the generalities of minority entities, we are much more than minorities. We are humans, we're Minnesotans, and we're Americans. But if you want to drill down into the Council on Black Minnesotans report from the auditors, here are the three significant things it says. One, our community support, our policy advisement work, and want it to continue. Two, they do not want to see the Council on Black Minnesotans eliminated or disturbed. And three, we are meeting our mandates. Madam Chair, with that, I would entertain any questions from any of the committee members. And thank you very much for having me here, and thank you very much for the great work you do on behalf of the great state of Minnesota.
And thank you, Mr. McDonald, and sorry it's such a short visit this time. We really will spend more time with the council in the future. Questions? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, no, I didn't have a question.
Okay.
So ask after this.
All right. Anybody else have a question? Then just comments. Senator Johnson, why don't you go ahead?
I was wondering if Executive Director Ms. Herr could speak for the Asian Pacific Council, even though she isn't on the agenda.
Ms. Herr is certainly welcome to, or anyone else from her board or from the audience is certainly welcome to. Thank you, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sia Herr, and I am the Executive Director of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And to my right is my Vice Chair, Mr. Tran Noen, who represents the Vietnamese Minnesotan community. First of all, let me thank the committee for this opportunity to just say a few words. It's always an honor to come before you. This is actually my second time, and it's actually just last week that I was here before you presenting with Senator Alice Johnson a bill on API women and domestic violence. And so With that said, I also want to thank Senator Johnson. She, I know that earlier when the OLA reported on attendance issues, Joe mentioned something about legislators and their participation rate, but I want to assure the committee here that our legislative board members in the time that I have been on board as executive director have participated very Let me just say that I haven't been disappointed with their level of participation, and so let me make that very clear. Thank you so much for your commitment and all of the phone calls that come to me late at night outside of work hours, Senator Johnson. So let me just say that, again, we see the OLA report as a tool, and we believe that with their findings and your support and your guidance that our council remains committed to fulfilling our statutory mandates. In an ideal situation, we would not hesitate to say that option number one is our preference. But I think given all of the findings and given the fact that many of the findings come to you directly from members of our community, as executive director, I am confident, I feel confident enough to say that our board is fully committed to exploring with you and members of our community what we can and can't do given our resources. I think that's a real issue. Having said that, too, I would just add that, you know, one of the senators mentioned a fifth option of sunsetting the councils. As I have said before to you in this very committee, the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans represents a very diverse community. We represent so many ethnic groups. When we say 40, when we use the word 40, we're talking about nations here. In countries like Laos, we have several groups that are here in the state of Minnesota. In countries like Burma, we have at least two ethnic groups here. So the Burmese, mainstream Burmese, and then the Karen. And so given the diversity and the breadth and the depth of this community, sunsetting the councils would be a great disservice to the communities that we seek to represent. So in essence, I am recommending, as a representative of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, an option that is about mending the councils and not ending them. Having said that, if Mr. Tran, to my right here, has anything to add, I would turn it over to him.
Mr. Tran?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the records, my name is Tran Non, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors. I want to recognize, first of all, the importance of the OLA report. They have pointed it out to us, so many deficiencies that we need to tackle. And for the days ahead, I think that this is probably will be a wake-up call for all of us to focus on areas that need for improvement. And in talking and in thinking about the other three options, if we do not have enough time to rectify the matters, then in the long run, I think those options are probably good to be considered by the legislature. But even the short run, if you do not give us adequate resources and probably a little bit more guidance, you will repeat exactly the same thing, which you put us all together in under the Department of Human Rights, or eliminate all of us and put us all of us to the Minority Affairs Council. So that's my personal thought. And I know that the board has agreed to find the solutions to really take seriously the OLA report. We don't just discard them and then hoping that everything will be okay in the future. Okay. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ms. Herr, Mr. Tran? Then Dr. Bruce Corey wanted to say a few words to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you for inviting me to speak, and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak. I've been around the Senate these past.
Just repeat your name, please.
My name is Dr. Bruce Corey. In terms of background that makes relevant to this committee, I chaired the Governor's Working Group on Minority Business Development in 2000, was appointed by Governor Ventura, and we had statewide hearings on strategies to grow the assets of minority business development. And so I'm not sure there's any a task force like that has happened after that on an asset-based approach to the communities. And I'm an economist by training, and so I present to the committee the economic portfolio of this asset in their communities of $12 billion purchasing power, 400,000 workers, of an asset of educational skills of $353 billion in lifetime earnings. And I think the challenge of this community, of the legislature, is how could we grow these assets? Because these assets are returning to the state at a minimum 11.5% in tax payment, and that's what a typical taxpayer pays in Minnesota. So while we I appreciate the conversation that's happened, and as I said, my admiration and respect for the legislature grows every day, because I've been going to different committees on different issues and seeing the quality of the conversation that is happening. And I would like to propose that the state has developed a coordinated vision for the community. Where do you want to see this community 5 years, 10 years down the line? And from that, how would these specific strategies work to grow this economic portfolio? And these councils serve as a vehicle then to implement that strategy. And so they could play a very important role, and Minnesota can play a very important role in the future. And I'll give you one example. I was recently at the launch of the Oromo Chamber of Commerce. It's a small group of immigrants coming from the Ethiopian region. And I went back and looked, and what is the trade to Minnesota from Ethiopia? And it was just $1.5 million. Now, could this group of entrepreneurs make that $10 million in 5 years, 10 years? I think they can. So there's all over, if you look at investors from China, India, Brazil, in the Iron Range, and the amount of investments in this global world that is happening, we can very effectively grow this part. And I just want to propose that that in making this deliberation, to please have a forward-looking approach, like has been mentioned here, and craft policy to that effect. But thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Senator Saxhog has talked about setting up an interim working group, and I thought maybe we could have discussions with him about doing a joint interim working group that would look at the auditor's report, because I feel like personally that I think the councils are very active in doing a lot of activities, and that part of the problem is in us in not providing more help in defining direction. Because if we really want them to be advisors to us and bring information, you know, where do they get that information? They go out to the community and gather it, right? It just doesn't come out of the board itself. So there has to be some of that, but they're supposed to be like the bridge to us from the community, because not everyone can come up here during session or feels comfortable or has the time or whatever. But these board members and these have volunteered to do that, to be that kind of liaison. So let's, I think the opportunity to kind of clarify what our expectations are of them, and then our openness. I mean, we need to be open then to hearing their suggestions and their opinions about legislation, or to bring us legislation that then we are willing to hear. And also to educate them about timeliness. Like, I'll just use Ms. Herr as an example, where she has this very serious, intense problem in her community, but because we're only in session for these few months, she has to know that she has to bring that issue to us early enough so that it can actually be in the mix. I did give her a hearing, but by then the finance chairs were already, you know, were pretty far along in terms of where their bills were at, and we weren't able to get her proposal funded. So just that kind of advice that we can provide to the council and that they can provide to us about the issues. So that's a suggestion that I have. I don't know if other members have any other suggestions for how we should move forward. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and I don't know if you can answer it, but I suspect Mr. Nobles could. Is there anything in law that prevents legislators from being voting members on this board, on these boards?
I think it varies by council. So I think some of them have legislators of voting members, I believe, and some they're ex officio. But we'd have to look up each statute to see. There's not a uniformity, to my knowledge. And maybe Mr. Nobles and Ms. Voss knows off the top of their head, because you probably have it in here.
Probably.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, there is, of course, always the issue of separation of powers. I think you have to look at the particular organization, and if it is not an organization that is making executive decisions, I think there's probably less of an issue for members to be voting members. I guess I would ask counsel to probably advise you on that. There's a bit of mixed practice, frankly, around state government with legislators being on executive boards and agencies. We have, for example, the IRRRB, which is largely, and I think now from changes made in law last year, all a legislative body and are voting members and vote on very substantial matters. So that wasn't much of an answer, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
They're all legislators, right?
Madam Chair, I
Ms.
could
Foss.
Add on page 5 of our report, we do show that all of the councils that we're talking about, they all have 5-4 non-voting legislative members. So no matter which of the councils we're talking about here,
they're non-voting.
They're
okay.
Non-voting. And mm-hmm. that in each of the enabling legislation for each council specifically says
non-voting. Okay.
Now, I imagine that could be changed by the legislature.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, I first of all just want to thank you for this hearing. I think it's been very helpful and productive. But as you know, Madam Chair, having been here over the years, there are advisory groups created within the legislative branch. As you consider how to possibly restructure this, and if the major focus is to provide advice to the legislature, there are mechanisms and structures that you've set up within the legislative branch, and then that issue of separation of powers goes away.
And another option you didn't come up with, that would be then under the LCC.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
The Legislative Coordinating Commission. Yeah, I think they were originally set up to advise both the legislature and the executive branch, but that might be too much.
And, Madam Chair, just to point to a specific example, as I'm sure you'll remember, the Economic Status of Women was a legislative branch organization. And then there are many others that are listed under the LCC. So as you go forward and consider restructuring, that is one option, an option that we didn't put forth, but it certainly would be there for you.
And the Office on the Economic Status of Women, as Mr. Noble said, was a legislative commission, so it was only legislators that were on that. And now it is still advisory to the legislature, but it's an office with an advisory committee, a legislative advisory committee. Ms. Hill, Anne-Marie Hill from the Indian Affairs Council, asked if she could address the committee. Ask her a question. Okay. Senator Torres-Ray, did you have a question before Ms. Hill speaks? Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just wanted to respond to your question about working with Senator Saxog as chairs to appoint a working committee. Mm-hmm. And wanted to perhaps provide a little bit of advice on how to approach this. I feel very strongly that having a working committee that begins with some kind of a structural document that incorporates kind of the findings of the report and some clear understanding of what we want to accomplish is very important. Oftentimes when we ask minorities to come together and provide advice kind of with an open invitation and no structure, we engage in a process of getting input that is very random. And I think that there are over 20 years of history in here that requires that we be a little bit more responsible about it and not approach this in a random way. So I would like to encourage you, Madam Chair, as kind of the policy chair, to really look into what are the recommendations, what are some of the assets that these councils bring to our communities, and what are the opportunities? And perhaps if the issue is to narrow some of those responsibilities and to restructure, that's what it is. When we open these conversations to kind of random opinions of individuals, you're going to have hundreds of people who have random opinions about how this goes. And so you spend a lot of time listening to really, I mean, constructive lessons, but lessons that do not help you deal with something that is very concrete. So I would like to encourage you, Madam Chair, to perhaps put out a document or some kind of a report even before we begin the process of appointing a committee.
A little bit like my conversation I had with Mr. Garcia is that we were not, nor do I think the auditor is calling into question the importance, the value of ethnic communities in Minnesota and their challenges and struggles. The question is, do we have the right structure to make the best use of that information exchange or flow? Ms. Hill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Marie Hill. I'm the Executive Director of Indian Affairs Council, and I am a member of Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and I've been at the Indian Affairs Council now for 8 years. Prior to that, I did have the opportunity to work for my tribe as a government relations director, so I was up here some 15 years ago sitting in committee representing the tribe, seeing things from the perspective of tribal government. Prior to that, I was a longtime staff member of the Reviser of Statutes and for the Department of Human Rights as an enforcement officer. So I came to the Indian Affairs Council 8 years ago with a wide variety of abilities to help me govern an office that is oftentimes difficult to govern because we have a charge under 3.922 that is very broad. We have many points in our statute that require us to do a lot of work. And I think that's one thing that we're talking about here is how exactly do we prioritize and how do we take a look at the internal structure? How do we maneuver and work with staff when the resources are small, the staff is small, and we have such a lot of work to do? So in the state of Minnesota, we have the worst disparities between our populations. We share that difficult data with each other in communities, and from the American Indian perspective, we're there too. So in the state of Minnesota, particularly with education, we're on the bottom in the nation, and that doesn't look so good. So we have so many things to do. I'm called to meetings of every kind, whether it's in probation, whether it's with corrections, with human rights, with health disparities, with education, and we try to meet every need. And at the same time, we remember that the state of Minnesota still doesn't educate people in this state about the very beginning, how we got here, about treaties, trust responsibilities. Since 1963, the Indian Affairs Council was established in 1963. That's 51 years ago almost, and it was the oldest and largest of its kind. And at that time, the purpose was to solve the problems that the citizens, the American Indian citizens, the first people of the state and nation had within the state. And so we have a lot of history here. We also, in the nation, we are the oldest and only council of its kind that allows for a forum in the state for leaders who have a trust responsibility to gather with leaders from the state to discuss the most pressing issues. And by and large, one of the leading things that I experience to this day is how do we solve these problems between jurisdictions that exist? We have a historic presence here. We have a trust responsibility, and we have a unique relationship, as we all know. But unfortunately, in the state of Minnesota, if we've been educated here, I was educated here as a Red Lake person. We didn't learn about this in high school. All I knew is that there were a whole lot of people that perhaps were Cherokee princesses or something else, but I didn't know anything concrete about myself other than where I came from. And still to this day, we exist in that manner in the state of Minnesota. We have not changed. I I would like, if I had an opportunity to point out everything how we see it from a perspective from the auditor's report, it would sound and look very different, and I could point to how we value our contributions and what we try to do and what we try to contribute to the state of Minnesota and how we try to help in the manner that we feel we need to continue to do and that we continue to need to bring voices forward. And we also made a concrete statement within the audit report that stated that we will move forward with some of the internal controls recommendations and so on and so forth. I very much appreciate Senator Torres-Ray's comments about the councils and the support that anybody has given, in particular to Senator Hayden when he pointed out that he tried to paint a picture. We're trying to do it with all within the council, plus we're also trying to manage a very concrete state agency with employees who are governed by labor relations laws, and we abide by policies, principles, and financial guidelines that are with us. We've had a tremendous amount of support from other entities within the state of Minnesota to help us do this. In particular, I got excited when you asked the question about voting. Now, who has the voting responsibilities on our board? On our board, each 11 tribal nations have a seat that's available to them. They are not mandated to be there. And I think it's wonderful that they can take the time and that they have the time from leading their nations to come and speak on behalf of each individual tribe. But they are the voting members on the Indian Affairs Council. The commissioners that sit around the council, and there are many, and the legislators, which are four, and the one representative from the governor's office, it's the largest of its kind in the nation, are not voting members. We have had the discussion about whether or not there are some legal issue. Why are you not a voting member? Why are you a voting member? But I think what helps me in my work as the executive director in addressing that is that I came from the neutral or bipartisan office. This helps my understanding. The bipartisan office of the revisor of statutes. Indian Affairs serves the legislature, and we do not serve one political party. We serve everybody. So it's very important that we have everybody's voices at the table represented, and that perhaps we stay away from one voting for one way and one voting for another because of a political reason or a definition of whether or not something is important. I think that the issues with our American Indian population that are affecting our children, the disparities, that doesn't necessarily mean they're affecting me personally sitting here, but I know the next generation's coming, that we remain neutral, we remain a voice, we remain an opportunity for everybody to speak, partner together, and to continue the discussion. So with that, there are technical answers for the voting, for the composition, et cetera, and so on and so forth.
Well, and Ms. Hill, we're mostly interested in if you feel there should be any structural changes to the composition of the Indian Affairs Council that would help you be more effective in, fulfilling the statutory duties.
Thank you.
Or changing
Senator
the
Pappas.
Statutory duties. Looking briefly here, I said they were slightly narrowed in 2007.
Yes.
But, yes. To be able to have you really because that nation-to-nation relationship is also very important.
It's very complex.
Right.
Senator Pappas, members of the committee, there's always room for improvement, and there's always room for discussion that should continue to happen based on how we best perform and best raise the most pressing issues in the state of Minnesota. And I do believe the disparities that we have and that we're hearing about, we didn't always hear about it from that perspective.
Are there any questions for Ms. Hill? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Or any other suggestions for what we might do as a committee to proceed? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, just looking at the recommendations here, especially on option one, they're giving recommendations from other states, such as for Asian Pacific American Affairs. The legislative auditor says, look at the state of Washington, and then they, talking about adopting policies and procedures, they recommend the CLAC policies and procedure manual as a template for the other councils. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we pick apart the recommendations from the legislative auditor, I think there are some great opportunities to look at what other states are doing, use that as kind of our guidelines to help us and making decisions, but also use some of the things that they're recommending here, such as the CLAC policies and procedures, and use that as a templates. So I think